From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Lauren Collins has investigated the precise number of roses that go into a bottle of Chanel No. 5. More recently, she covered the gender pay discrepancy scandal that has rocked the BBC and driven new questions around salary secrecy and reporting requirements in the UK, Iceland, and other parts of the world. As a staff writer for The New Yorker, Lauren Collins lives in Europe with her French husband and now two children. It was the evolution of her relationship with Olivier, two people with two different mother tongues, that became the focus of her book, When in French, Love in a Second Language, one of the New York Times' 100 notable books of 2016. The book is more than a chronicle of an international love story, though. It takes a deep etymological dive framed against her sometimes clumsy, often belly laugh-inducing anecdotes about navigating Switzerland, a country she finds surprisingly restrained, and her new relationship with Olivier's very French family. Collins divides her book into seven parts, all named for grammatical tenses. The final chapter, The Future, or Le Futur, explores her dawning realization that she will continue this complex language journey with her newborn daughter. We are talking about this today because Lauren Collins also happens to be a native Wilmingtonian who graduated from New Hanover High School. She joins us now. Lauren Collins, what a pleasure to welcome you to Coastline.
Rachel, I'm absolutely thrilled to be here, not only as a guest, but just as a longtime listener and donor. Well, my mother has donated, but I feel
that
I can take credit for that. But we're big fans, both of the station and of your show. And so this is just an extra special thing for me to be here talking to you today.
Well, thank you so much. The pleasure is ours. And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Are you bilingual? Have you learned a secondary or even a tertiary language? Do you have your own question for Lauren Collins? You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Lauren Collins, you write in your book, "The Great Design Flaw of Human Communication is the Discrepancy Between Things and Words." How did learning French as an adult take you to that realization?
Let me start by saying that I never expected to be sitting here talking to you about having learned French after meeting my French husband and living in Paris and having my kind of, bilingual kids. I grew up in Wilmington. Like most people, didn't do a lot of traveling, a lot of speaking French growing up in Wilmington. In fact, I took Spanish not particularly successfully in school and didn't get my first passport until I was, well into my college years, with which I went to London and spoke English. And then I think eventually went to Paris. But this is all to say that, first of all, I took on French not as a self-improvement project, not because I was especially a Francophile even, but because I met someone and I suddenly found myself, in a position in my early 30s where if I wanted to communicate with him and with his family and with pretty much everyone around us, this was the thing that I had to do. So, I joke, but it's actually kind of true. People ask me, how do you learn a language, especially in your, I was in my mid-30s and your brain just kind of calcifies at a certain point, a shockingly early one. It's like if you're a child or your teen, but even after the age of 12, I think is what researchers say, it's really a different, neurological level. Learning a language is really hard after that. But anyway, people ask, so how do you do it? Like, what's the secret? And the secret is that you face like pretty dire negative consequences if you don't. I'm a firm believer in negative reinforcement for language learning. I mean, it was really the thing that finally lit a fire under me after many years thinking, oh, hey, wouldn't it be nice to learn French? But I had to is why I did.
And it was more than an intellectual exercise. I mean, that's what took you into this book, this whole idea that, you explore a lot of language philosophy, including the idea that language shapes your experience of the world and your perception. Where did you wind up with that?
Well, it's funny. So I started learning French, and it was kind of my secret project. I mean, I didn't really want to tell anybody about it because, you know, what if I failed? And was it kind of pretentious? And, I was living in Switzerland just trying to do this thing. And meanwhile, writing about all kinds of other things and just going about my job like I always had. But this is, unfortunately, for better or for worse, what happens when you're a writer. But whatever you start getting really jazzed up about in your personal life inevitably spills over into your writing. And if I look back now at the things I was writing during those years, it's kind of like a trail of breadcrumbs leading to this book. And I started getting interested in just different languages. I started reading a lot about, what scientists thought about language, all sorts of different things. And I really wanted to know, ultimately, whether people see the world differently through different languages. And there's a great kind of divide of opinion on this. But I think most people you speak to who do speak different languages answer that you do see the world differently. I mean, I will be curious to hear from readers, not readers, listeners, if there are people who call in. Because I think, there are a lot of different reasons. You might be at a different point in your life. You might be experiencing different things. But there are also just fundamental differences in languages. With French, for instance, you have to decide whether every single person you meet is vous, the formal form of address, or two, the informal one. And so you're just, moving through the world differently, making, thousands of tiny decisions every day that I think kind of add up to something in the end.
You write, you open your book with this experience. This was like the first moment you seem to have understood that you really need to start learning. You talk about being forced into this, learning French out of a need. And you have this wonderful scene with a chimney sweep.
An actual chimney sweep, yes.
This was reminiscent of, something out of Mary Poppins. I don't know if that was your intention, but you say he actually wore a top hat. Would you read some of that for us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, I started the book with this scene because it was just such a surreal experience, and I wanted to open just explaining to the reader how kind of lost I felt, how, homeless, in a sense, I felt without language. So here goes. This chapter is called The Past Perfect. I hadn't wanted to live in Geneva. In fact, I had decisively wished not to, but there I was. Plastic ficuses flanked the entryway of the building. The corrugated brown carpet matched the matte brown fretwork of the elevator cage. The ground floor hosted the offices of a psychiatrist and those of an iridologue, a practitioner of a branch of alternative medicine that was popularized when in 1861, a Hungarian physician noticed similar streaks of color in the eyeballs of a broken-legged man and a broken-legged owl. Our apartment was one story up. The bell rang. Newlywed and nearly speechless, I cracked open the door, a slab of oak with a beveled brass knob. Next to it, the landlord had installed a nameplate, giving the place the look less of a home than of a bilingual tax firm. A man stood on the landing. He was dressed in black, t-shirt, pants, tool belt, a length of cord coiled around his left shoulder. In his right hand, he held a brush. Creosote darkened his face and arms, extending his sleeves to his fingernails and the underside of his palms. A red bandana was tied around his neck. He actually wore a top hat. I hesitated before pushing the door open further, unsure whether I was up against a chimney sweep or some sort of Swiss stripogram. Bonjour, I said, exhausting approximately half of my French vocabulary. The man, remaining clothed, returned my greeting and began to explain why he was there. His words, though I couldn't understand them, jogged secondhand snatches of dialogue. Per law, as the landlord had explained to my husband, who had transmitted the command to me, we had to have our fireplace cleaned once a year. I led the chimney sweep to the living room. It was dominated by the fireplace, an antique thing in dark striated marble, with pot hooks and a pair of side ducks, whose covers hinged open like lockets. He poked around for a few minutes, letting out the occasional wheeze. Coming out of the arabesque, he turned to me and began again to speak. On a musical level, whatever he was saying sounded cheerful, a scale-skittering ditty of lay and la. Perhaps he was admiring the condition of the damper or welcoming me to the neighborhood. He reached into his pocket, proffering a matchbook and a disc of cork. Then he disappeared. Minutes went by as I examined his gifts. They seemed like props for a magic trick. More minutes passed. I launched into a version of rock, scissors, paper. Since the cork couldn't conceivably do anything to the matches, then the matches must be meant to light the cork. Action was required, but I feared potentially incinerating the chimney sweep, who I guessed was making some sort of inspection up on the roof. Eventually, he returned, chirping out some more instructions. I performed a repertoire of reassuring eyebrow raises and comprehending head nods. He scampered away. I still had no idea, so I lit a match, held it to the cork, and tossed it behind the grate. The pile started smoking and hissing. After a few seconds, I lost my nerve and snuffed it out. The chimney sweep resurfaced, less jolly. This time he spoke in the supple, obvious tones one reserves for mad women, especially those in possession of flammable objects. Reclaiming the half-charred piece of cork, he lit a fire and, pot belly jiggling, sprinted out the door. Finally, he returned and reported, I assume, since we used the fireplace without incident all that winter, that everything was in order. Au revoir, I said, trying to regain his confidence and my standing as chatelain of this strange drab domain. Hello and goodbye, my two words, were a pair of bookends, propping up a vast library of blank volumes, void almanacs, novels full of sentiment I couldn't apprehend. It felt as though the instruction manual to living in Switzerland had been written in invisible ink.
Lauren Collins reading from her book, When in French, Love in a Second Language, one of the New York Times 100 Notable Books of 2016. She is our guest on Coastline today, and you can ask your own question of Lauren Collins by calling us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or emailing us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's a conversation with Lauren Collins, graduate of New Hanover High School and Princeton University. She's also the author of When in French, Love in a Second Language, and she's a staff writer at The New Yorker. She lives in France with her husband and children, but she's visiting her family in Wilmington, and she joins us today. And we want to hear from you on this Wednesday. Have you struggled with a second language? Have you learned new words or ideas in another language that you had never encountered in English? Give us a call and tell us about it on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. We have an email from Kathy who writes, I am bilingual. I learned a second language when I was over 40. My daughter's father does not speak English, so in order for us to communicate, I had to learn one of the five languages he spoke. I learned French and also some Arabic. As an older adult learning language, my advice is place yourself in situations where the only language spoken is the language you want to learn, and to have no shame, make mistakes, and be prepared to laugh at yourself a lot. People appreciate more that you are trying and will help you along. Go hang out with the women when they are cooking, and you will not only learn the language, but also learn about the food and culture. Lauren Collins, you had so many moments when you describe moments of embarrassment when you're struggling through learning French and you say something that isn't exactly what you meant. Can you tell us about some of those moments?
One of my all-time greatest hits, and there were many, but just to pick one moment of shame, was right after I met Olivier. You know, I think it was the first birthday that he had celebrated with me in his life. And so his mother sent me this email, and I kind of, you know, deciphered it using Google Translate and whatever resources I had at my disposal. But what she wanted to do was send a coffee machine to our, you know, place of residence for his birthday. And all I had to do was accept the thing and put it in a closet, essentially. Easy enough. But in trying to, you know, hatch this little scheme with her, I had to reply and tell her, right, like, Roger got that. Here's the plan. And I really, really wanted to do it perfectly, right? Like, I hadn't even met her at this point. And so I get out all my dictionaries and I write the thing and I check and I double check it. And it wasn't until, you know, months or even years later when I was sort of comfortably settled into the family that I learned I had wanted to tell her I've accepted delivery of the coffee machine, which somehow came out in my rendering as I delivered the coffee machine, like I gave birth to it. you know, and it was like really kind of anatomical and medical the way I said it. I mean, it was just awful. Like, I have completed a successful natural birth with no epidural of this Nespresso machine that you sent. So that was one that really early on was one of my kind of classic humiliations. But
and then, how is that because you reread your reply to her years later, or did they ever say to you,
no, I think
by
I'd
the
been,
way?
Yeah, I think I'd been like, it had been a family joke for some time at that point that I was finally let in on. But yeah, it was the word delivery, which, you know, isn't a perfect translation that really tripped me up that time.
You've broken this book into parts based on language tenses, past perfect, the imperfect, the past, present, conditional, subjunctive, future. How did that idea come to you? Was that something that evolved as you wrote the book, or was it early on in the outline?
I thought about it before I even kind of decided officially to write the book. It was really while I was taking some language classes, I was learning these tenses. And of course, I mean, this is something that anybody who's studied French or other Romance languages will know, but you have two different past tenses. Like, you don't just say, I ate the hot dog, you know? It's either like, I was eating hot dogs, you know, a lot of times in the past, which is the imperfect, or I ate the hot dog, which is the past tense as we know it. And so I kind of was thinking, well, how do these notions of the past and, of course, memory and storytelling apply to my own story? Like, would I say I grew up in Wilmington, or would I say I grew up in Wilmington in the imperfect tense? Anyway, it seemed like it was a perfect way to kind of map a story, particularly one about my own life in a memoir. And so, no, it was just kind of like a fusion of the two things I was doing at the time, which were learning, you know, learning language and thinking about kind of my own journey toward doing that.
And talking about the genesis of this book, you talked to Ben Steelman, I think, of the Star News. Mm-hmm. And you said that you wanted to write a book for years but didn't have a topic until you reported on an effort to purge the European Union of bad English phrases. And you said to Ben, that lit up my synapses and I followed it like a trail of breadcrumbs. What were some of those phrases?
Let me think. You know, so there, it was great. I mean, this was just a tiny little story, but this is, as I was saying, you know, just looking back, I had this kind of growing interest in language and linguistics and thinking about how languages affect our worldview. So there was this great guy. He was like a lifelong EU bureaucrat. I'm not sure. I can't remember exactly what he did now, but it was something like he worked in the Commission of Fisheries or I don't know what. And he had been compiling a list for years and years of phrases that offended him. He was a native English speaker, and phrases that offended him in what he called EU-glish, which was the international version of English. And it was really interesting to think about that there's English, but there are so many different versions of it, and people even end up having to translate internally, you know, amongst Englishes. I think there's an international English that, you know, is a kind of very sanded-off version, an easier version that people all over the world use, and it has developed, like, its own idiosyncrasies and quirks, too. I remember one of the words was normally. There's, you know, people using it not to mean,
as a matter of course.
Right. But, like, if all goes according to plan, you know, normally we should be able to have a picnic tomorrow. at 1 o'clock. And so that's just one little, one of his kind of little, you know, persnickety entries that he made. But I loved this, that this guy had, you know, spent kind of years of painstaking effort on, you know, I think his ultimate goal was to purify the EU of EU glitch, and certainly he hasn't succeeded in that quest.
That whole idea of purifying language is an interesting one, because in your book you cite this 1954 paper by Alan Ross called Upper Class English Usage, which I guess seeks to establish linguistic habits and even word pronunciations that would separate the middle classes from the upper classes, or I guess you would want to be in the upper class separated from the middle class. And the work later, you write, was popularized by Nancy Mitford in her essay, The English Aristocracy, in which she bemoans, among other things, the vulgar use of what she calls the Christian name. So how do these efforts at language purification, do they ever go anywhere, or is this just part of the evolution of language? And you're going to have your, I guess, prescriptivists who want to say, okay, this is the standard, stop here.
Right. I mean, I think one reason I included that, I mean, it's also just so much fun to, you know all the little gradations of British English snobbery and language. I think serviette is considered so common, and you want to say napkin. It's really all the Anglo-Saxon words are the upper class ones, and trying to say anything, you know, with a kind of French tinge, like toilet rather than loo, is putting on airs to the English upper classes. But I included that as an example of kind of this, you know, sense of pretentiousness that surrounds French sometimes in the English-speaking mind. I mean, I thought it was so funny, but it also, you know, played into my sense of intimidation with the language. And I thought, you know, who am I going to become if I learn this language? Will I still be me? Can you be a Wilmingtonian who didn't get a passport until she was 20 and also become a fluent speaker of this language? I wasn't just, somehow they felt, if not intellectually mutually exclusive, emotionally mutually exclusive. And so this was my part, you know, that was part of my research, part of my attempt to get my head around, what is this language? Can I be a part of it? And if so, how?
And just looking at this very common perception of French snobbery around English-speaking Americans specifically trying to learn the language, did you find that? Kathy talks about that in her email, saying, you know, people will laud you for trying and they'll help you along. Is that true in France?
Well, I went back, you know, because I was thinking about what is this kind of like stigma that sometimes surrounds French? You know, it's a great attraction, but also kind of a repulsion. There's an interesting relationship between French and English and France and America. And then when you add in Britain, you know, it's kind of this amazing love triangle where there are always alliances and whatever between the three countries. But yeah, I think there it's interesting that we kind of applaud people, you know, as Americans, we're like, wow, that's amazing. You learned French. How did you do it? But then here there are people like the listener who wrote in's husband who speak five languages. They just don't happen to be English. And with immigrants, it's often, hey, come on, buddy, speak English. And so I think there's a double standard there that is really unfair. America is a really interesting country. Linguists know it as the graveyard of languages. It is actually the place where people come, I mean, immigrants, they lose their first languages, their native languages, more quickly than almost anywhere else. And it's because, you know, there is this idea of assimilation and of melting pot. And people do tend to, you know, learn English and get really good at it really fast. But the listener's email was also interesting to me. I loved what she said about, you know, go in the kitchen and talk to people and you'll two-for-one deal, you get some recipes, too. That is the other great thing. I mean, the gift of learning, you know, of acquiring another language, another culture, often goes along with it. And whether, okay, so, you know, let's say you meet someone who speaks a different language, but also somebody who's of a different race, of a different religion, even just somebody from another place in America. I mean, I think to some degree, we're all translating in our relationships. And, you know, you try to talk to somebody who's different from you And it's hard, and there are all kinds of setbacks and struggles, but you also get kind of, you know, double the recipes, in my case with French, double the movies, double the magazines, double the holidays. There's a great richness to be found in reaching out across these, you know, language and culture barriers.
Do you think there's any link between this dynamic that you talk about that linguists call, you know, when linguists call America the graveyard of languages? Is there a link between that and growing xenophobia?
Well, I think there is. I mean, one thing I was interested in, I remember kind of the Freedom Fries era. And, you know, I think you'll all remember the era when Congress actually, I believe, passed a resolution. I have to fact check myself there. But anyway, in any case, French was removed from, you know, French fries in the congressional cafeteria. And even aboard Air Force One, I believe instead of French toast, they had something like, you know, Freedom toast with strawberry whipped cream, or I can't remember what. French's mustard had to issue some sort of proclamation saying. Anyway, I went back to that era, and of course, that movement, you know, came about not far from Wilmington. It was a North Carolina restaurant that first kicked all that off. And yeah, I was really, really interested in how this idea of someone speaking another language just is this flashpoint. I mean, it's, you know, often the source of great admiration, but also kind of a lightning rod for, you know, people also get mad when they hear people speaking other languages.
And you talk about
terrain,
that in the
yeah.
book as being part of your experience in Wilmington. Like, you say there's a tinge of xenophobia, and you're talking about a couple of decades ago.
Right. I was writing about, like, when, you know, when I took Spanish, for instance, in high school. I mean, there was never a presumption. There was never any suggestion that we might become immigrants. It was kind of, learn Spanish and then, you know, maybe you can talk to somebody working in a restaurant. Wouldn't that be great? And so there's all kinds of class baggage. There's all kinds of political baggage. And I wanted to go back and just untangle some of that.
And part of your experience in Wilmington, you also write about it being this community where the same people are going to be there at the beginning and at the end, which is sort of the flip side of that idea of xenophobia-tinged,
right,
closed culture. Do you think that it's changed, or do you think... And was that dynamic specific to Wilmington, or do you think that's an American thing?
So I was writing, that's something I love about Wilmington. I mean, I think there's such a sense of comfort and stability and, you know, for lack of a better way to say this, knowing who you are-ness to be found in a community where, you know, there's a real sense of cohesion. Of course, the downside of that is, A, it's hard to be accepted if you're a newcomer or if you're different. And B, even if you are, you're going to have to conform. I mean, the price of cohesion is conformity. And so that's, you know, and kind of a balance I've really struggled with. And, you know, growing up in Wilmington, I moved to London, I lived in Switzerland, I live in Paris now. It's like such a push and pull and a give and take. How much are you willing to give up to seek new experiences?
Do you feel like you gave anything up ultimately? I understand the fear standing on the precipice, but once you've made the leap, did you give anything up?
Yes. I do feel like I've given things up, like, living in a place where like 50 people would come to my funeral. I mean, that's kind of what I was writing about, this incredible power in knowing people and knowing their, you know, knowing people and people knowing you through every stage of your life, and that sense of continuity amongst the generations. I mean, not only having known my friends from Wilmington since I was a child, but having known their parents and their grandparents and those links back through the generations. That said, I feel like I've gained more than I've given up. I mean, I wouldn't have made that. You know, that was the bargain I chose because I thought that I was getting a deal in the end. And that's what it goes back. I mean, these sort of the benefits and the the payoff of all these things, as I was saying, you just so much is opened up to you when you move around a little bit.
We have an email from Francisca. She says, I live for 30 years in the USA, learned English here. She asks, do you agree that speaking two or more languages and living in a different culture makes you richer and broader in different ways of thinking?
What a perfect question for what we were just talking about. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I just think these dividends, I guess, is the best thing to call them, keep replicating themselves. And, right, like, you know, let's take it back to the other listener's example. You learn a new recipe, and then that takes you to another thing. It's like, oh, now I love this cheese. Well, then you hear about the next one. And I feel like there's this kind of domino effect of opening yourself to new things that means that it keeps paying off. Whereas, you know, if you stagnate, then that doesn't happen.
You talk about, and I think this was an interview that you did with Vogue, paraphrasing the critic George Steiner, saying you're performing a feat of interpretation anytime you attempt to communicate with someone who is not like you. And this is borne out in your attempt to learn French and Olivier's attempt to communicate with you in English. Does this also connect to this larger cultural divide that we have and this kind of loss of our practice of civil discourse?
Absolutely. I wish I thought of that myself. I think that's such a clever and perceptive way to read that. And that's what I was thinking about. I mean, I read Steiner and he was talking about how translation not only occurs between languages, but inside them. And that was a real revelation for me. That was something, an epiphany, and it's something I think about every day when you look at the divided state of, you know, our country going on down to our families.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. Lauren Collins, writer for The New Yorker and author of When in French, Love in a Second Language, is taking your questions. You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this short break, you'll have just one more segment to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Lauren Collins is my guest today. She works as a journalist for The New Yorker. She has written a book, When in French, Love in a Second Language, chronicling her journey into the French language and culture through her relationship with her now husband, Olivier. And she's visiting Wilmington, which is why we're fortunate enough to have her with us today. You can ask her your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And Lauren, we were talking earlier about this idea of purging the European Union of bad English phrases and some of the co-opting of English into other languages. You actually have a section in your book when you're exploring words for things and ideas, phenomena, that we don't have in English. They're just single words for things. And these would be things that would have to be descriptive phrases in English. Could you just read that section of the book?
Of course. And before I do, I have to apologize to all speakers of Finnish, Mandari, Indonesian, Swedish, Turkish, and Italian, because while I did write this book, that does not mean that I can pronounce all of it. So I'll do my best. Okay. Schnapsidee, the way a German would describe a plan he'd hatched under the influence of alcohol. Pilkunusija, Finnish for comma, a word I can't say on the radio that starts, comma, effer, we'll say, a grammar pedant. In Mandari, ributibri refers to the sight, sound, and motion of a fat person's buttocks. Jeus in Indonesian denotes a joke told so poorly that people can't help but laugh. Nulrufs is Swedish for post-sex hair. Gumu servi means moonlight shining on the water in Turkish. Culicino is the Italian word for the mark left on a table by a cold glass. Words like these are marvelous. We make lists of them, compile them into treasuries, trade them over any dinner table at which holders at which holders of more than one passport have convened. The German, armed with Kummerspeck grief bacon, will always win the day. They're fun to say, they're funny to think about in their Seinfeldian particularity. They expand and concentrate the world, making it bigger spirited while at the same time more specific.
Lauren Collins reading from her book, When in French, Love in a Second Language, one of the New York Times 100 notable books of 2016. Also, before we leave the book, you write about experiencing celebratory nights through Olivier's family and the French culture, just endless drinking and food that goes on hour after hour into the wee hours of the morning. And when you explain this experience, you never talk about what I'm thinking, which is, how do French people do that and still squeeze into a size 2?
I think they have all kinds of – I mean, I have to say, first of all, just being in Wilmington this summer, one of my greatest Wilmingtonian pleasures is like a nice 5 o'clock dinner, a nice 5 p.m. dinner and, out of there by 6:30. But, these feasts were, just wonderful and hilarious in their own right. You know what they do? They eat soup for dinner, 10 nights after that. But they are,
So there's compensation.
I think so. No French person would ever tell you that, but I'm here. I'm here to say, yeah.
Michael from Wilmington called in. He says he recently switched his phone over to French to learn the language faster. Any other tips, he asks, to learn a language faster if you can't immerse yourself in the culture?
I love that. I think that's a great idea. I still learn a new word every now and then because I've done that too. But there are some really good apps. A lot of people love Duolingo. I haven't used it myself, but there are even apps that are more, you can get apps that help you conjugate verbs. There's an app for everything. Podcasts, obviously. A lot of people say watching television. That was never great for me. you turn on a television show and it's like slang. There's a lot of dialogue. It's like people talking how people actually talk, which is really different, really difficult to jump into if your language skills aren't already at a certain level. Television, I think watching French television, for example, with French subtitles turned on is a better way to start if you have that option on iTunes. But, technology is really great for this sort of thing. You can get a Skype partner for almost any language. There's just there are endless resources out there. So yeah, do what you can and what fits into your schedule. And the progress is incremental.
You are a staff writer at The New Yorker, and in March of this year, you wrote a piece entitled "Fragrant Harvest: How Many Roses Go into a Bottle of Chanel No. 5?" How did that question arise in the first place?
Well, it's funny. When you say write a piece, I feel like I wrote captions practically to these beautiful photographs by Perry Dukovich, who's a New Yorker photographer. But we had a style issue. We have a style issue every year, and I think someone knew about this kind of they're just acres and acres of kind of secret fields that Chanel uses down in the south of France for Chanel No. 5. And, they're unmarked and there's no sign. And it's because this is where, it's their kind of oil field practically for it's where, their natural resources come from. And it's one family that's been growing the flowers for years and years. And so I got to go down there and spend a day watching the flowers being harvested. And it was really really magical and cool to learn that something, as global a product as Chanel No. 5, you find it in every airport duty-free and whatnot, but it has a terroir, as they say in French. It comes, at least part of it, from a very specific plot of soil in a specific part of the world, and I found that fascinating.
You say the bees arrive at 9:30 each morning. Is that just Monday through Friday, or do they show up?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're French, so they don't even show up in August.
Okay. But. And you also, I noticed you talk about being with the farmer, the rose farmer, the year before in May. So at what point did you know that piece was going to be published?
I reported the piece in May, and then we saved it until the next year. Because, obviously to catch the thing, in full effect, you have to go and then you hold it for a year and run it at the same time the next year.
A piece you published last month in The New Yorker addressed an equal pay issue within the ranks of the BBC. And you peg that story on the experience of one career BBC journalist, Carrie Gracie. There are a number of jaw-dropping moments in that piece, but from the moment that Gracie learns she's far from being paid fairly after she insisted before taking the job that she earn an equal wage, BBC brass told her she would, and that was part of her the reason that she accepted that job. How did that story wind up on your radar, and had you experienced anything like that yourself?
I got really interested in it because for several reasons. I mean, in the past few years, I've had two children in the past 3.5 years, and inevitably, I mean, you think before that happens, oh, I'm never going to get into these boring work-life balance conversations. That will never be me. And of course, it is you. And you start thinking about, why do women make less money than men generally? I mean, why does this gender pay gap exist, which is different from equal pay but related? Why do more women work part-time? And then Me Too happened this year, and we were all, thinking about that more than ever. Anyway, my kind of hunch before reporting the story and my, confirmed conclusion at the end of it is that so many of the problems that we all wring our hands about and talk endlessly about how to solve really come down to women, systemically being paid less than men.
Talk about this not being a discrete issue, like it's connected to sexual harassment. It's connected to exploitation of women. Why?
Exactly. It's so complicated. There are so many reasons. But first of all, the gender pay gap is much more exaggerated for minority women, for women working in, professions such as housekeeping, in domestic professions. And so there's this entire environment where women are just – the easiest way to say it is women are presented with a slate of really poor choices. And even when that happens completely illegally, it costs too much for women to pursue remedies. So it's this, it's this self-perpetuating problem that leads to all kinds of other problems. And so I just became interested in it, and I thought Carrie Gracie's case was just kind of a spectacular case study of how this happens and, more importantly, what women can do about it.
The moment she learns she isn't being paid fairly, when this list of salaries and the highest paid people at the BBC is published, mm-hmm. men, of course, at the top, the highest woman being more than £1 million below the highest paid man, Gracie initially blames herself, you write.
Right. And just to establish, so Carrie Gracie was the China editor of the BBC. She was one of four foreign editors, two women and two men. And through a series of disclosures that British law essentially forced the BBC to make, she found out that she was being paid about 50% of what her male colleagues were being paid after having been promised equal pay, just to give a little bit of background. But, if you read the story and just knowing a bit of her career, she's a fearless woman, this kind of trailblazer, someone who speaks fluent Mandarin and went to China and reported these hard stories under police surveillance for years and years, not a shrinking violet. But yeah, that was her first reaction, like, what could I have done differently? That was a poignant moment to me, hearing even someone like that initially turn the blame towards herself.
Now, is that a universally female dynamic? Does this point to the confidence gap that Caddy Kay of the BBC co-identified with the American journalist Claire Shipman?
I think part of what it is, and this was what was so interesting in reading about this subject, is having this feeling like, I tried to do this all right. I asked. I had the conversation. I leaned in. That was the thing. She was consciously trying to lean in. I mean, she had literally just read the Sheryl Sandberg book Lean In, and she left her kids at home in England, and she said, "I'm taking this big job. I'm doing it." The problem is, what I learned in reporting the story is women lean in at great risk, even when they use the same strategies as men, and just tons of studies have backed this up, but they use the same strategies as men, and then they're punished for them. They don't work. And so I think, you know, it was a moment of self-flagellation of Gracie kind of thinking, well, I followed all the rules. I did everything you're supposed to do. So the problem must be me. She found out, you know, as the story unfolded, it wasn't her.
And this movement that emerged specifically from this BBC problem called BBC Women is fascinating. You write that they strategized in secret. These high-profile BBC stars would accompany less-known, more potentially vulnerable colleagues to complaint hearings about this issue, which just struck me as an extraordinary level of cooperation among women. Is that a sea change? I mean, is that one of the positive elements of the discovery of this issue?
They knew that solidarity was critical to their cause. And so they just came up with every single little thing that they could do to make this a collective issue rather than just one woman saying, I'm not being paid enough. And actually, I mean, the thing that was so striking about the stand that Kerry Gracie took is she also said, I don't want the money. This isn't about money. This is about my work being acknowledged and my dignity. And in the end, she got a settlement of several $100,000, and she donated it all to a legal fund for women. So I think this was like a very, you know, pure and principled example of women just saying, we really must be paid equally for our work.
She talks about not wanting to win this battle just for herself, but wanting to win it so that the next generation didn't have to fight the same battle.
Exactly. And also just for, you know, members of this generation, I mean, people who are working now who didn't have the platform that she did, who couldn't raise their voices in as loud a protest because they were more vulnerable.
And you, the way you end the piece with a quote from Kerry Gracie, who ultimately won that fight, explaining the impact of solidarity, you write that she says, if you tell me I'm rubbish, I might believe you. But if you tell me she's rubbish, I know it's not true.
Yeah, and that was the multiplier effect of this movement, of their solidarity. I mean, as they all started talking and organizing and their stories came out and they all figured out, you know, it is impossible to say when, you know, hundreds and hundreds of women at the BBC are saying, we support Kerry and this happened to me too. It's impossible to say, well, this is just one, you know, this is just one unhappy woman causing a stink.
Before we came on the air, we have just a few minutes left, but we talked briefly about the coup d'etat of 1898, which is celebrating, I think it's the 120th anniversary this November. And first of all, you've expressed interest in this now, years later, after growing up in Wilmington. What did you know about it? What did you learn about it when you were a child growing up here versus what you know now?
I knew that something had happened in 1898. That something was presented to us at the time as a race riot, which I think is, you know, a really inaccurate way to describe it after learning more about what happened. And so I never really knew the real story. And I became interested in it more recently in 2016. There is a local filmmaker named Christopher Everett. He made a fantastic documentary called Wilmington on Fire. I can't remember where or how I heard about it, but I did, maybe even on Facebook. And I thought, okay, Wilmington on Fire, I've got to see this, you know. And his tagline was kind of like, before Tulsa, there was Wilmington. And so in 2016, I interviewed Chris, and I wrote a little story about him, and we've just had some fascinating conversations. So I've started thinking, you know, a lot more about it.
And so we might see more from you on this front.
Yeah, kind of having the, you know, stirrings of hoping to write something
and that's
about
this,
Wilmington. So
that's our time. Lauren Collins, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster and today's call screener. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.